I really like the book. I especially like the midsection of the book in which you dealt
get
a lot
with Alcoma, Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah. Where you dealt with the childhood of both of the cousins and.
Well, I think that's one of the themes of the book that you know, the appeal of childhood. It's about the loss of childhood, obviously, and what Bobby signifies to her is her childhood. That's the time that is appealing because it seems to have coherence. Whereas today, New York and the West Coast, and you know, our life doesn't have any apparent coherence.
I liked the scene in the theater a lot. I had a feeling you might have been sitting there about that time. Is that true?
Which theater? Now
that was the one in which the bluegrass musician.
Oh
was
yes,
playing,
I used know. To visit that little place all the time. I'd sneak off from home and go down the hill and listen to the hillbilly music. And one of the things that really always fascinated me was how the bass fiddle player always went behind the screen and came back transformed. And that was sort of the miracle of theater, that somebody could transform himself.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a child, you didn't weren't quite sure that it was still the same person. You noticed that he had disappeared, but you weren't quite sure that it was still the same person.
Mm. What town were you born in Mississippi?
A place called Holcomb, Mississippi, which has a population of about 150 people. It's in North Mississippi. It's about 50 miles from Oxford, about where Faulkner was born, about 20 miles from Carrollton, Mississippi, where Elizabeth Spencer, a wonderful Mississippi writer, was born, and about 100 miles from Jackson, Mississippi, where Eudora Welty was born. The soil is very thick with writers in Mississippi, as you know.
Well, there's certainly a Southern heritage in literature, isn't there?
There is, indeed. And we recently had, in fact, a Mississippi Writers' Day, which I had a lot of trepidation about going back to visit. An anthology had been done of Mississippi writers, and it is, in fact, quite impressive. It's incredible. The number of writers, Richard Wright, Eudora Welty, Walker Percy, Ellen Gilchrist, Willie Morris, William Faulkner, the list goes on and on.
All Mississippi.
All Mississippi. Mm. And the question, of course, was asked, why are there so many writers from Mississippi? And the best that I can conjecture is that whenever you read a Southern writer, but particularly a Mississippi writer, you really hear a voice talking, and it's like talking on paper. When Mississippi writers write, you hear a person talking. Even if you read it silently, you hear a voice talking. So we like to talk, and those of us who write talk on paper.
Mm. I think that's one of the reasons I liked Looking for Bobby a lot, because while you did have a major scene at the beginning, of course, in New York, so much of it took place out of New York, and I guess living in New York myself for 18 years and reading so much about New York, so many stories are set here, it's almost refreshing for me to go across the Hudson and read about areas of the country that I'm not familiar with, and that's one of the reasons I liked especially that middle part. I was also struck because I found out, it wasn't until the end that I found out the Bobby's mystery.
Yes.
It carried all the way through the book, and I'd almost resigned myself to saying, well, Bobby's just an elusive character, but I think you did a nice job. You sewed everything together very nicely.
Well, in the conventional novel, you lay all the clues for the character early on. But in real life, in fact, you can think you know a person very, very well. And in fact, you may meet them at a time in their life when they will tell you their story and you'll be utterly surprised to learn who they really are. And of course, Marianne, growing up in the shadow of her older cousin, Bobby, who was this golden boy who did everything perfectly, saw him in a kind of glow. So she wasn't observing him as closely as her usual sharp mind observes everybody else. She was seeing him in a special halo.
I have a friend who's not like Bobby at all in most respects, but in one he is. Bobby is the kind of character who adopts things passionately and then tends to discard them. I have a friend who's just like that, who will go all out on, say, bicycling and maybe buy 5, 6, 7 bicycles. And then a year later, they're all discarded out in the backyard. Or it just goes haywire over things. It's just a passion and interest, and then he just loses all of that passion after a while. Bobby strikes me as that kind of person.
He's that kind of person. He's very brilliant, but he never seems to hold on to anything and carry through. And a woman I know in publishing who's very brilliant has said that everybody is going to call you up. Every woman who reads this book is going to call you up and say, I know all about Bobby, and let me tell you about mine. And mine was named Sheldon Finkelstein.
Oh, you must have been away from Mississippi for a long time. I just hear a little trace of the Mississippi in your voice, but not very much.
I've lived here for 15 years. For 15 years.
I shouldn't have done it. It's not enough time to lose your Mississippi accent. Maybe you never had one.
I sort of dropped it as a kind of self-defense, because you find if you're a southerner in New York, you often encounter a kind of reverse prejudice that everyone assumes there's a sort of image of the Southern Belle, and there are a lot of jokes made about you, and people misperceive you and sort of expect you to be Scarlett O'Hara.
I think people also in New York, even though New Yorkers have generally a very pronounced accent, they tend to depreciate people who have accents. I had an uncle who lived here for a while, and he's from Oklahoma. And he worked for the Mobil Oil Company. He is subsequently retired. He was in charge of Mobil's offshore oil drilling in the North Sea. And a very successful man. And my father's younger brother. And so Uncle Bob would call me on the phone, and it would be Uncle Bob on the phone and wants to talk to me. And, and the people would answer the phone, and they think there's some yokel on the phone calling me. But this man, he lived up in Weston, Connecticut, a beautiful house, and he has subsequently retired to a lovely home in Texas, and absolutely the opposite. And dynamic, creative businessman and oil explorer. And yet the accent, it just threw people off. And I wondered about that a little bit, because when he came up, I had Uncle Bob and his wife also from Oklahoma for dinner, and I thought, boy, you know, with that accent, they're going to have a hard time up here. But I guess they didn't. They didn't like it very much.
Well, that's sort of typical of New Yorkers, because we live in this place where people don't know each other. We tend to judge people very much by the surface, how you wear your hair, whether your part is right, whether you have the right jewelry, whether your accent is right. We really judge people by the surface, because we don't have that kind of deep history of a family or person as one does in a small town.
What? Speaking of small towns, you grew up in one. How did you spell the name of the town?
Alcoma, A-L.
No.
Oh,
your real hometown.
Holcomb, H-O-L-C-O-M-B.
Was there anything as you grew up in Holcomb to give you some indication that you would someday be a writer and out with your first novel?
I just always loved reading books, and one of the great luxuries of my childhood was that I didn't have many children to play with, so I spent all my time reading, and I had an aunt who gave me a lot of books, and I had the time and the inclination to sort of dream and make up stories. And it was a long time before I decided to be a writer. I went to college. I went to graduate school majoring in speech science, where, in fact, in that era, teaching machines were very popular, and I developed a teaching machine to help Midwesterners lose their Midwestern accents. This was at Ohio State, you know.
You went to Ohio State? You didn't go to some small Methodist college?
I did go to a small Methodist college in Mississippi, but I went to graduate school in at Ohio State, which was a big reaching out in the world. And
You helped Midwesterners to
lose their Midwestern accents, you know.
What?
To generalize American.
I thought that a Midwestern accent was as generalized as you.
No. Midwesterners nasalize their vowels. They say things like, oh, damn, it's going back to raining.
Yes, but I thought a Midwestern was exactly a Midwestern accent. That means a middle accent, which is unaccented.
No, Midwestern really has a very nasal quality, very identifiable. And while it's fine for speaking in the Midwest, a lot of Midwesterners want to lose that. So I worked on that.
Like a Harry Truman accent.
Yes, I can't remember Harry Truman too well as to how he really talked. Ronald Reagan does not have a Midwestern accent, for example. In fact, one rarely hears a Midwestern accent on the public media. Well, now, of course, with Dan Rather and Jimmy Carter's heard something of a Southern accent, but not a Midwestern accent.
Mm-hmm. You studied speech at Ohio State, huh?
Yes, yes.
Were you writing at all during your college years?
I briefly wrote, took a course with Peter Taylor, and he suggested I should go to the Iowa School, but I had seen enough of college then, so I took a bus to New York and took a $65 a week job working as a secretary in a publishing company, which is the traditional way to start. You type letters, and they let you read manuscripts on the side. And eventually I worked my way up to being an editor-in-chief, and about 5 years ago, I decided I really must write. You know, a lot of people who work in publishing always have a novel somewhere in the drawer that they're going to complete someday. I was working about 60-hour weeks, but I said, Sunday is going to be my day. So I just sat down and started writing, and I wrote a number of short stories, which I was lucky enough to have published, and three of them have appeared in the O. Henry Prize Stories. So then I said, well, short stories are fine, but a novel is the real thing. So I wrote this over about 4 years of Sundays and vacations.
Mm. Yeah, what publishing house did you work for?
I was editor-in-chief of Book of the Month Club.
Uh-huh. Well, your husband also worked in a publishing house. Didn't you meet there?
Yes, at my original job, we met there. He worked in the next aisle over and lived in my neighborhood, and we shopped at the same grocery store, so we were thrown together.
What house was that?
Holt, Reinhardt & Winston.
CBS House.
Now, yes.
I don't
think
it was then, was it?
It was then.
Was it then?
Yes.
When did CBS acquire that? Do you remember?
In the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s. That was the time when publishing was very glamorous, and a lot of large conglomerates were buying publishing companies because that was the era of the big textbook education expansion. And, of course, since then, education has shrunk, and a lot of large conglomerates have sold their publishing interest.
They found out that nobody reads books.
They found out that it's hard to sell books.
trying, don't we?
Not enough Americans read books, but enough do. You know, one of the things about books is that they have a much larger influence than just those who read them. I really feel that they are very much carriers of new ideas. It's not very expensive to produce a book. It's very expensive to produce a television program or other forms of communication. And sometimes our most influential ideas really come from books.
Oh, there's no question about that. But when you think about it, since you worked in publishing, you probably can endorse this, although you may not. Well, maybe you won't endorse it. But books are a very inefficient way of reaching people because, one, they have to be written. They have to be printed. They have to be physically bound. They have to be carried or shipped and mailed. They have to be purchased and dragged around. Having an enormous book collection in a Manhattan apartment that take up room and they clutter the house.
But they're wonderful and they're portable and they're replicatable. Let me say a word about book prices, too, is that people think books are too expensive. You know, a novel is $15, a person says. On the other hand, if you go to a movie, it's $5, and you sit there for 2 hours. However, if you buy a novel, it takes you about 6 hours to read, so the entertainment value is the same.
If you like the novel.
If you like the novel.
Spend
but you don't always.
$20 for a novel, and you can't stand it.
You don't always like the movie either.
You don't even, that's true. No,
you expect a lot more of a book than of a novel.
I'm being a devil's advocate, because I started doing book reviews here in 1967, and I wouldn't have a 7-day-a-week broadcast on books and authors.
I didn't care about books.
But I think you have to admit that it's not a very efficient way of reaching people. You obviously are going to have a printing of a novel. Well,
5,000 is an average.
Yeah,
3,500.
First novelist for yourself would be something in that nature. A more established novel builds a little bit when you become. I just interviewed somebody had 150,000 first printing. I think it was Michael Korda. Queenie, I think it was, 150,000 first printing. I mean, they're really expecting people to buy that thing. But when you think about it, 150,000.
It's not very big in this country, is it?
How many people can you reach?
200 million people in the country, and 150,000 are going to read that book?
Well, they're going to buy that book, maybe.
Yeah.
maybe they'll pass on the book. Then there are paperback sales, which will ultimately, hopefully, paperback sales for many novels that will hopefully expand that. But how many people will watch a television show at one sitting?
Millions.
Millions. How many read a book then? I mean, that's... But I have a feeling that the book ultimately has a bigger intellectual impact. I was talking to Harry Blackstone. I did an interview with him last week, the son of the famous magician. Yeah, he's a magician himself.
Is he? Is he?
Harry Blackstone Jr. Yeah. has his own magic act. And about late 1960s, his father was still alive, he did a summer broadcast on the craft television theater or music hall or something like that. And they got the figures back the next day, and 29 million people watched that broadcast. And Harry's father told him, he said, Harry Jr., he said, 29 million people watched you last night. He said, that's more than ever saw me in my entire career. But Blackstone Jr. told me that over the years since that broadcast, hundreds and hundreds of people came up to him to say they remembered his father and the magic tricks that he had done in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And to this day, no one has ever come up to Harry Blackstone Jr. to say he remembered his appearance on the Kraft Music Hall.
Oh, you're giving me goosebumps. That's really a wonderful story, and I think that's so illustrative.
That's because you watch television and then you forget it.
Yes, it's like disposable food.
But you pick up Looking for Bobby, and you read this book all the way through, as I have. You're not going to forget it.
Uh-huh.
It may not have been the most passionate experience in someone's life reading a specific book, but they gave themselves a commitment. They made a commitment. They sat through a book and read it over a period of a couple of days or hours or whatever, and it's going to have much more of an impact and meaning.
And two, television sort of gives you what you're going to be watching, and you don't interact with it. But when you read a book, some of your imagination and some of your own experience has to go into the book, so you recreate it yourself. It's kind of recreative entertainment.
Now, you're a judge at the Book of the Month Club.
Yes, I am. Now I have more time to write.
Now, tell me a little bit about that. I have never done a story in the Book of the Month Club. It's probably something I should do, but what do you do as a judge?
Well, you read manuscripts and you think about them very carefully. And then every 3 weeks I meet with my other judges, Clifton Fadiman, Mordecai Richler, Wilfred Sheed, David Willis McCullough, and John Hutchins, and we have lunch and talk about the books that we've read and which one we think is the best and should be the book that month. So it's a very, very pleasant and invigorating kind of job.
Well, don't you have to do a lot of wading through books you probably hate?
As editor-in-chief, I did read a lot of books. Incidentally, it's hard for me to hate a book. I'm a very book-liking person. But now I read more of the books that have already been waded through, although I do a certain amount of reading of books that I'm just interested in or books that I think are sleepers and I would like to read myself.
Well, does the editor-in-chief, as you were, bow to the decision of the judges, or how does it work?
Yes, the judges' board, this is a unique thing about the Book of the Month Club, were from the very first year it was founded in 1926. Harry Sherman, a marketing genius and a great understander of American culture, decided to create a board of judges and writers who would select the book to ensure to the members of the club that they were getting not just a commercial decision, but a decision based on merit. So it's really our job to say what we like.
But the Book of the Month Club mixes up its books quite a bit. It's not all literary, isn't that true?
That's right. That's right. There are 15 main selections a year, and that doesn't mean that every book should be, you know, a literary book. It's a book that will interest a great number of people. It could be a topical book. It could be a book like a great suspense book. It is what's going to appeal to a lot of readers.
Why do writers want their books distributed by the Book of the Month Club? It would seem to me that wouldn't that cut into bookstore sales?
No. Just what we were talking about before, Don, that there's so little distribution of books in America that basically anything that gets a book out there and gets it in the hands of a lot of people and makes them start talking about it is good for a book. It's not as though there's one finite market, and if you sell 50,000 books, there's not going to be another 50,000 people to read it. The real problem is to get people to talking about a book and having read it. So with the Book of the Month Club can distribute 100,000 or 150,000 copies of a main selection to its members, it's only going to help the book.
Does Book of the Month give the author a flat fee, or is it also based on royalties?
It's based on royalties. In other words, there's a royalty per book sold with a guarantee, a basic guarantee.
Mm-hmm. How long were you or have you been with Book of the Month?
8 years. 8 years.
I have one gripe against Book of the Month.
Oh,
and because
if you have a bill problem, I'll take care of it for you.
No, I hang out at the Strand, and But I always tend to pick up Book of the Month Club editions, which seem to me to be inferior
no,
in quality.
Absolutely,
they're smaller,
not.
More poorly bound. It's not the same edition as the one that originally came out.
If you're picking up a Book of the Month Club book, and I won't mention any other book clubs, it is identical. The only thing that's different is that the price doesn't appear on the jacket, but it will be equal in quality. It's not smaller. Same binding, same glue, same everything.
Same plates you use?
We use the publisher's film, yes. The same films as the publisher's films, and it will not be an inferior edition. There's a slight difference in the jacket because it's treated differently for shipping purposes. And as I say, the price doesn't appear on the jacket. But other than that, it's identical or superior to the publisher's edition.
Okay. I don't mean to confuse Book of the Month with inferior book club, but there are book club editions. There are
yes.
obviously book club editions
yes.
that are not very nice
That's true.
Books.
That's true, but it's not true of books.
Because I like to pick up a book, and you know, I love Knopf.
Oh, isn't it wonderful, those pages and the word on the type at the
yeah.
back?
Knopf is absolutely the trade publishing houses, it's absolutely the best in terms of the quality of the
They do
the
a terrific job.
Yeah.
They do a really terrific job.
And also, Knopf has the best stable of writers. I probably do more Knopf books than and authors than any other.
But of course, it's a great pleasure to be published by them. I was very happy. My agent, I completed the book before I sent it to anyone, even though, you know, one might sometimes sell the novel half completed. It didn't occur to me to do so, and my agent sent it to Knopf, and they took it after a weekend's reading, so I was very, very lucky.
After how long?
1 weekend.
After 1 weekend. That's wonderful. Well, now, you have been in publishing for a long time and in a position to look at manuscripts and this sort of thing. Here you had worked for 4 years and looking for Bobby, and you finished it and you sent it off. Did the editor who bought the book go back to you and say, oh, I love the book, we're going to buy it, but these are things we want to do to change it? Did this happen to you?
Sure. There were editing suggestions, and I was very happy to have them because a writer who can't rewrite is never going to succeed. That's one of the basic abilities that you have to be a writer.
Did the editor encourage you to change the direction or thrust of the book in any way? Or what? What kinds of changes, editorial changes, does the editor have? The editor ask you to do
there
to
are
make,
more
in general?
Clarifying the characters, cutting certain things. Adding a few things to clarify why Marianne is this way. Why does she feel isolated from other people? Why should she adore her childhood cousin so much? Why, if this is a story about the loss of childhood, how can you illustrate it better? Things like that. I'm really asking you questions of what did you really mean? Well, you didn't say so, so say so. I enjoy working with an editor. It's you know, just like really polishing off the job.
I would also assume that the editor, if the editor is a good one, gives you a lot of moral support, which I think probably, being a failed erstwhile writer myself, is important because you want to play your words off of someone else and you want them to be understanding. And I think that's the way. I mean, sometimes when I write, and I just play around with it, but I just have a feeling that nobody wants to read it. You know, I can't find anybody who's really interested. I remember I gave a novel that I had written a few years ago to my former superior, who's also a novelist and written 12 books.
Oh,
and
who is that?
H. Paul Jeffers. Does mostly mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
With Joan Kahn, St. Martin's Press.
He just might have been the wrong person to read it, you know.
Well, I had written a mystery novel, and I gave it to him.
Oh, then it was.
Yeah, I gave it to him,
uh-huh.
And because he said he wanted to read it, and he gave it back to me the next day with several suggestions. And some of the suggestions were areas that had been covered in the novel. I just didn't read it carefully, you know, with any degree of thought. And I just had a feeling he didn't really want to be bothered, that he had other things to do than read some amateur's attempt. And it would seem to me that this is, to a degree, overcome when you have an editor such as yours at Knopf who looks at it, because there's also an economic investment involved here, but I could be wrong in never having worked with an editor, but it would seem to me this would be something really important for a writer, and probably this is the case with you. Is that correct?
Yes, it's very good to have, you know, that other ear. You work in isolation, and you have no idea as to whether you're really getting across what you want to get across. So you meet this person who seems to be sympathetic to your work, and you trust him, and he says, this isn't working, Gloria. And so you know, it's a very great support, a feeling that there's somebody there who is telling you, who's backing you up and saying, you're giving me a message, but I'm not getting it. And I know what you're trying to say, but I'm not getting it.
Assuming you trust the...
Yes. Editor. It's very difficult to find someone to read your work carefully. Very difficult. And what I found at Book of the Month, my job as editor-in-chief, was to screen some 5,000 manuscripts. And I had about 50 readers who read books. Well, I was always suspicious of the reader if he didn't like the book. And my job was try to pair the book with the right reader. And one of the things that I discovered is that people don't read books. Books read people. In other words, if you're a sort of cynical, sardonic person, you're never going to like a romantic novel. You're going to think it's stupid and silly. If you're a romantic person, you're never going to like a satirical novel. So my job was really to try to pair it with the reader who would be sympathetic to it. It's funny. It's most people have the same reaction to nonfiction. You can give Iacocca to readers and they'll mostly have the same reaction. But if you give a novel to two equally intelligent, sensitive persons, one of them may love it and one of them may hate it. Because a novel is really about life and the author's vision of life. And if it doesn't happen to be your vision of life, you probably won't like it.
That's very nicely put. Well, Gloria Norris, to kind of wrap things up, you are married to a novelist who also has a new book out, Yuri Pomeranz. What's it like being married to another writer? Is there any feeling of competition?
Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's terrible. It's not so much competition, but just different needs at different times. For example, I'm very much a person who gets up and doesn't want to talk to anyone in the morning. That's when my mind is really fresh and ideas are crowding in my mind. I want to get to my typewriter. Whereas my husband is a person who thinks a good morning's work is to have several cups of coffee and read the New York Times and chat. And then by about 12 o'clock, he's great for going in the room and working for 8 hours. So that's a conflict sometimes. He wants to talk, I want to be quiet. Then, of course, in the afternoon, I want to talk, and he wants to be quiet.
Do you share each other's manuscripts, flip them over, and
yes, and that's a very good asset. But we don't really hover around each other and say, this is what I did today. When a reasonable amount of work has been done, 50 or 100 pages, the other one will read it and say, this is good, that's not good. And it's nice to have a person who's sympathetic, as you were saying. It's so hard to find a sympathetic, careful reader who will presumably tell you the truth to and say, this stinks, and I like that. And this isn't working, and I like that character, and why don't you build him up? The only problem I really have with my husband is that he likes my characters so much he steals them.
Dishonest. Do you each have a separate workspace, or do you have two typewriters clacking in competition?
We have separate workspaces, but I can hear when I'm not typing, but he's typing. When I'm typing, I can't hear anything.
That must be maddening. You come to a dead spot, and you can't type, and all of a sudden you hear his down the hall.
That's right. One of the characters I'm worried about in my book that he's trying to steal is an actor named George Grimsby. He's a minor character in my book, and I didn't have a chance to really work him out. But Gary likes him so much, he's trying to steal him to put in a new book of his that he's writing.
Give it to him. Well, my wife used to, when my son was little, to show you this lack of sympathy, I think. But I would be sitting in our dining L, trying to shield myself from the noise of the television set and the monster kid and all that stuff. And be pecking away at my Smith Corona, and the kid would come over and be a nuisance, and my wife would say, "Don't bother Daddy while he is typing."
Oh.
And that used to drive me up the wall. And then finally I said, look, I'm not a typist. I use two fingers and a thumb. I've been using it ever since I got into journalism. And I'm not sitting here typing. I am writing. I am not typing.
Well, man,
she can never differentiate.
That's almost the material for a mystery story. The wife keeps telling him that until he murders her with a typewriter ribbon or something.
Don't put ideas in my mind, please.
I have two words of advice for would-be writers. One is, find a quiet space to work, even if it's out in the back of the boiler in your basement. You can't work with other people around. And the other is to keep a journal. I think that's terrifically important. You think that you will remember all your thoughts and you'll remember everything, but you'll find if you just write a few things down every day that something will accumulate and you'll look back over it, ideas will flow.
Well, I use earphones now, and also...
Earphones. Muffle the noise.
Walkman earphones, but classical Rachmaninoff, the music just becomes kind of like a wall, and that's kind of nice. However, my son now is much older, and I have an empty bedroom, which I'm about to make into an office.
That'll be terrific.
I'm looking forward to that. Also, another thing that I'm using now that I just absolutely love is I have a Macintosh computer, and it is just so wonderful in cutting through all the mechanics of typing and changing paper and revising, and it's just wonderful, and it gives you more time to focus on your real work, which is your writing.
So would one say, "Don't bother Daddy while he's at
his
computer"?
While he's playing with his toy. Don't bother Daddy while he's playing with his toy. My wife considers the computer a toy, you know. So
I have not gotten that technologically advanced yet.
We just went computerized here in the newsroom.
Uh-huh.
And
still two fingers?
I use, I had a journalism professor, I guess it was my junior year, who caught me using two fingers, and they made me take a touch course in typing, suspended me from all journalism classes until I took my touch course in typing, which I sailed through, of course, but... As soon as I left the class, I went back to my two fingers, and that's what I use now.
So you passed the class, and then you went back to two fingers.
Yeah, actually, though, there was a legitimate reason for using for touch typing. One, with two fingers, you have to... do you touch type?
Yes.
Well, if you only use two fingers, if you touch type, your hands cover the keyboard pretty well.
Yes.
There's less of a tendency to make typographical errors. If you use two fingers where you have to mm-hmm. go up and down, it's much easier to strike wrong keys. So I kind of wish I'd stuck to the touch. It was very difficult. I taught myself to type when I was 6 years old, and here I was 18, 19 years old in college, and all of a sudden I had a change, and it was maddening. I just could not... I mean, I could fake it in the typing class.
Uh-huh. When you're typing.
You know, I would
typing.
Go like that when the
now
teacher
the
came by, I would go back.
All.
What's that?
Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party. You could type that.
Well, I could type very fast, and then when the teacher came by, I would go back to the all fingers. And when she turned her back, I would go back like that. And then when she came back, I would go like that.
So it was just a habit you could not change.
Well, it was. Can you imagine if after years and years and years being ingrained like that, and not even having to look at the keyboard,
uh-huh.
all of a sudden you had to change it.
It was too hard to make
it
that change.
Very,
that's like
it took a lot of discipline. No, I didn't have it.
Like losing your Southern accent.
Well, I lost my Texas accent. But Gloria Norris, it was wonderful. You're certainly an engaging person. I'm glad to have also found out, in addition to your work looking for Bobby, but a little bit about Book of the Month. And I certainly appreciate your coming in.
It's wonderful. I'm so glad you do this program.
Well, it's one of the few that will focus on the kinds of books that we like.
Yeah.